What do you think he's pursuing right now in North Carolina?
Is he still at Bojangles?
What time is that you posted that he was at Bojangles?
It was like a couple hours ago, right? So then that would have been an hour ahead of us too. Like maybe six.
So you think he took a red eye?
Oh, he did. Yeah, he did. 2 in 1 week, I think he said. Which, no thanks.
Yeah, I don't understand. I literally, like, I spend probably 30 hours of my 40-hour work week trying to just understand Andrew. And even as a full-time job, I cannot. But Andrew,
yeah, if you're listening, was that part of the job requirements?
When we got hired, my role shifted. When I went from to staff developer, it was just...
Staff developer and therapist now?
Yeah, like, you know how shepherds, like... have staffs, like, you know, rods. That's actually what it means by staff developers. I'm here to shepherd Andrew through his life and his career. Well, Andrew, if you're listening, you're an idiot.
You don't pull punches.
He does listen to this, so that will...
I know. That's the only reason I did it.
Now the wait is for how long you get the text, like, dude, what the hell, man?
Well, okay. Drew Bragg texted me when I was at Rails World. He was on his flight in and he just sent a rolling eyes emoji and he slacked it to me. And I was like, damn, I really pissed Drew off. Like, what did I do? And like, he was traveling, so he wouldn't respond. And so I'm like, oh my God, what's happened? He finally responded. He's like, you made a joke on Remote Ruby. I guess I made a brag joke. Like, I guess Drew's going to probably send me a rolling eyes emoji after that. I don't remember saying that at all. But anyway,
beautiful.
So yeah, gotta be careful. You know, one time we tested you and it was me and Andrew recording to see if you listen.
Oh, you know I don't listen. Wait, now yeah. I gotta text you guys the rolling eyes emoji.
It wasn't that. I don't remember what it was. We gave you a code word. If you gave us the code word, we knew you listen.
Well, I do not listen. I don't like listening to my own voice and stuff, so.
Dude, we were sitting in the kitchen yesterday. My oldest son, like, he was getting ready for school and he just goes, I can't say your name because she'll trigger. She was like, Apple Intelligence, play Remote Ruby podcast. A, I hadn't heard our new intro before, so that was cool. B, it was immediately sounding my voice. And so literally I'm getting his lunch ready, just listening to like us talk. And I was like, this is my hell. Anyway,
that's pretty funny.
Enough about this crappy podcast.
Well, welcome, Seth Tucker, to the show. You get to replace Andrew, so that'll be quite the challenge, I would say. How long have we known each other? It's been years now, but I don't remember how long.
Informally, a long time since GoRails was on Slack, which has been a while.
Right.
And then in person, 3 years. Because that's when I started going to St. Louis.
Yeah, it's a small world. Two of the guys at RailsConf that I met also live in St. Louis. And I was like, no way. Like, we need to go hang out. And I guess our St. Louis Ruby meetup is reviving like this month after like July or June 2023. It was like when the last movement happened on anything. And now it's like, unfortunately, it sounds like it's a sub meetup during another meetup. It seems kind of strange, but it's like the secret club.
That sounds like when retailers did the store in a store, which is
yeah, it's like the Starbucks inside of Target is pretty much how I feel. That's got to be it. So anyways, sorry for making you wait in silence while we intro'd about Andrew the whole time. But do you want to give yourself an intro? I'll let you take it away.
So my name is Seth Tucker. I'm a developer at a company called Noink. We are a voter registration platform, or at least that's the part of the product that I work on. We do a bunch. It's for the US and parts of Canada for the election system.
The secret parts of Canada.
Yep, the secret parts of Canada.
The northern part.
Yeah. Nobody knows what happens there.
Working for voter registration sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds very political too.
You don't work at this kind of company without being prepared and being very tolerant, or at least tolerant, but usually accepting of other people's views and being very willing to work with others. Just the nature of it. You just don't get people who aren't going to allow it and be able to have conversations, be able to exist around it.
That makes sense. I was surprised that you had any free time at all right now, given it's an election year here in the US.
That just is because we've done a good job.
Oh, good, good.
Software that's well-written runs itself. If you're having to constantly band-aid your software, you're doing something wrong. That's what it comes down to. If you write your software correctly, you should be able to sleep at night and everything's great. Here's the other thing, that the other nice part is that anything government related is always about stability. So once you get it right, their requirements don't change. And we get to freeze the technology that we're using to be at the most stable, secure, predictable, reliable part. That's the biggest thing with anything government related. The other thing that kind of shocks people too is that our clients aren't the federal government, they're states and their local counties and election boards, because counties and states are responsible for implementing elections. So when you think about the technological demands of a state government or counties, they're a lot lower than like a federal agency would be.
Learned about that in 2020 when all of a sudden we started talking a lot about voter registration. So
yep.
Learned about the state's involvement in that.
Outside of, you know, podcasts like this, I don't tell people that I work on anything related to the election. I tell them I work on national security and that I can't tell them any details because otherwise the amount of people that come out and they're like, so it's your fault. And I was like, I didn't work here until 2021.
It's national security. I can't talk about it.
Yeah.
For what it's worth too, we also don't do ballot tallying. That's a completely different company. We do pretty much everything else but the ballot stuff. So nothing to do with that part. Sorry.
You have a hanging Chads module in your code somewhere.
Our code base is actually relatively old. It's over a decade old. You know, I can't talk details, but big picture stuff. We're mostly a Rails monolith. We have some Elixir services for some external things. And then we actually have a little bit of Crystal that we sprinkle in for some of our own tooling, which has been really helpful. You can have all these systems, right? But when you're trying to get people set up and you have other services, it's really nice to be able to just give them a binary and run a service than it is to try to give you a Docker image and then maintain a bunch of Docker images across these services. And due to how the structured things work, we can't not have services. So we've tried to avoid services wherever possible because they just add a lot of complexity. But when you need it, you have to have it, and it's nice to have, and it's been convenient.
That's really interesting. Is Elixir used for parts that are heavy traffic, like lots of concurrent
custom integrations? Actually, now custom integrations with customers that have their own technical teams, because like you have certain counties that are, you know, large population counties, think like California, New York, those kinds of states where you have really densely populated counties. They have super sophisticated needs. They have very large systems and they have their own staff, so they can afford to do stuff. And then they have IT departments, they can integrate users. So they do that. So they don't get direct access to the monolith. They go through these external interfaces and then we can customize behavior for them without having to change the main product much, which is nice.
That's really cool. What's the big challenge on the Rails side of things?
This is going to sound funny. Data transfer. It's the volume of data that comes through and the format that it comes through, because you're interfacing with the majority of extremely legacy systems. Like JSON is a big ask.
Do you send PDFs and upload them to an FTP server? And
no, it's a lot of CSV files and tab delimited CSV files and escapes. And then you have to support special characters, which you don't normally, like most other apps, you don't have to run into. But because you have so many different languages and different regions that you can run into, you've got to have a wide character set and nuances like that in a tab delimited file add all kinds of wild, wild complications that you would just never think about.
You create your database, UTF-8, whatever, and it's kind of, kind of done.
Yep, but until you run into a special character, and then you've got a whole region that needs Cyrillic added because they have Polish and they have some Russian and they have some Ukrainian, and you're like, oh, wait a second. My American brain is not prepared for this.
Yep. There's a lot of that stuff that we take for granted. I mean, heck, even it was maybe 2 years ago that I happened to be browsing a map of time zones and noticed that like not all time zones are 1 hour apart. There are some that are 15 minutes and 30 minutes. And I was like, I had no idea. Just don't run across that ever in the US because we have only a couple time zones and that's about it. You know, they're all pretty straightforward, but that's fascinating and probably some pretty fun stuff to work on, but also tedious work in a lot of areas, I would imagine.
I I do a lot of the security stuff, which is great, but I can't talk about it because the nature of security is that it becomes less secure as soon as you talk about it.
Yeah.
So at least when I say I'm doing national security, I'm not like, I make sure the CSV file is okay. No, I am actually doing some very cutting edge security stuff. All of our devices are with Apple and we have direct connections in with Apple and their security team. So it's very cutting edge. It is so cutting edge, actually. You can't Google answers to stuff. I'm super into AI. AI solved a lot of my problems because you cannot Google a bunch of these answers. You have to have some type of depth of knowledge and articulateness to get answers and phrase questions correctly and get context.
Somebody accidentally trained it on a bunch of secret NSA documents and you're like, just finding answers in OpenAI on accident there.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. No, thankfully not that bad. It's more like working in binary formats. So like I've always thought of inter-system communication using JSON. That's basically what my entire career has been. But that's actually super inefficient in terms of when you get to the large amounts of messages that have to get sent, you actually end up with more of a binary structure. And working with binary in Ruby is painful in my experience. And this is probably mostly from my angle because I just didn't do this before, but it's painful. But having these long strings that you can then parse that have a certain bits in an arrangement that you're then extracting out and then turning into an object and working on is the kind of thing you end up with, which there's a web standard you can actually look up. It's not secret because it's a web standard, but it's called Web Authenticator, which is a binary format, which has all kinds of particular things in it. And then you can customize and stuff details you want in it to build on top of it. Highly recommend people check it out because I had no idea it existed. It's been around for a long time and it is quite impressive. It'll also break your brain for a little while, so be forewarned.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I was doing anything like that. There was one joking about the PDFs and FTP servers earlier. There was one like banking service that I was using, I don't know, 10 years ago that was pretty similar to that, where it's like the first byte is this and then the next two bytes is this thing, and parsing all that stuff was breaking my brain a little bit. But it had been since college that like I had done anything with binary and stuff. Like we had a couple courses where we were writing assembly and one on some electrical engineering, building a CPU from scratch and whatnot. And like, that's really fun. And I've been recently watching the 8-Bit Guy and Ben Eater's YouTube channel is phenomenal. They take the 6502 CPU from the Apple IIs and everything else in that era. And then he like puts RAM chips in a breadboard and then wires everything up and then teaches you how Wozniak wrote the BIOS for the Apple II and stuff like that. And it's all from scratch. He has a little 8-bit display that he like wires up and hello worlds and then does all this cool stuff. It is so much fun. But like in Ruby and Rails land, we are like light so years away from that.
Yeah, so detached.
It's wild because like, you know, he'll run a command and like turns a pin high or low and like now it gets power and the LED turns on and you're like, I just say something in a library and it does that. But like he was literally writing assembly to set the register to turn that pin on and yada yada. Whoa. And like he's actually talking to the CPU and I feel very far from that.
Am I even a programmer?
Well, and it becomes easier and easier for AI to write the code for you every day that like, what do I do anymore? I just kind of like write rules and say like, this is what I want it to do and what you should do during these edge cases or something. And I could imagine that in the future, you just end up writing the tests and then it is a description. And that's the exact same thing you're telling AI is like, here's what I want the output to be. And it can figure out however to wire that up. And you don't really care. As long as the edge cases are handled properly or whatever, that's like the biggest thing. And maybe you have to go into the weeds a bit more to make sure that's correct, but like it's wild.
That's actually like really close to the AI research that I've been doing on my own. Like that's just like my obsession in my spare time for this last year and a half. And that is really, really, really close to it.
What people can't see is real quick to set some context is behind you is a beam saw, some chainsaws hanging on the wall. You're just like a lumberjack also writing AI. Yep. And
I'm a lumberjack incognito as a developer.
It's a great contrast between the cutting edge and the literal cutting edges behind you.
I'm actually a professionally trained timber framer in historical timber framing. So I can use only the hand tools. I don't have to use the power tools. Those are just for convenience, but I have all of the hand tools and knowledge and have done the capability. I can go out, cut down a tree, hew everything in the spot and turn it into a building.
So you're going to end up
interlocking being, joints, no nails, all that stuff.
You're going to end up being, if AI does destroy everything, you're already set to live in the woods alone from everything. Yep. So you're just safe, ready to go.
Yeah. Perfectly safe. Yeah. I'm even using antique tools from before technology even existed. So actually that's funny. So most of the tools behind me are 100+ years old. So the antique tools that I have for timber framing are, I got mostly through yard sales and antique finds, and they're from the 1800s.
That's incredible. I love that stuff. Like, I hated being drugged to antique shops and stuff with my parents when I was a kid, but now I look back on it and I'm like, this is the coolest stuff. Like, it lasted several hundred years, you know, but everything we build today lasts. You write some code, it'll last a year or two before something changes and a library breaks or whatever. And, you know, it's hard to make stuff last like it used to.
You can't quite see it. So this is my last thing about the tools and then we can move on because I'm sure nobody listening wants to hear about tools they can't even see. But this thing here that's got these two handles, it's a very simple little thing. It just looks like a wood post and it's got a little seat on it with a couple of handles to crank. It's an original beam boring machine. It was just a boring machine. And you would put a bit in it and you can drill holes because back in the day, they didn't have power tools. So you just lug that thing around. It is pretty light. My favorite thing is, when people would see me using it, because I used to do frames in my front yard in the inner city. So you'd always get people that stop and talk and they're like, wow, that looks so hard. And I'm like, it's not hard at all. Here, hop on, give it a shot. And they're expecting to have to sit there and like crank with all their strength. And it's easier than riding a bike and the joy that people get from it. It is amazing. They just light right up. They're like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. And it's the greatest experience to share.
That's so cool. And anytime something looks hard and then turns out it's actually easy is like, one of the coolest things. There's sort of a default, I feel like, of if things look hard, then they are hard and I won't even try it. I won't even explore it. And when you really get into things, it's like, yes, programming is hard when you look at it as a whole, but like every little piece of programming is not hard. If you want to do some math, you can use any language and in 5 minutes, you can do some basic math and you've been programming. You want to like put strings together and do whatever, like that's not that hard either anymore. Maybe it is if you're writing assembly and the limited amount of registers that you have, that is a little different than what we're used to being able to just make a variable and name it whatever we want. But that stuff is really cool. I think when I first met you, you were doing a lot of Crystal, the programming language, and you're now the maintainer of the Amber framework. Is that right?
Yep.
So Amber, you might need to refresh us on this, but Amber was kind of like, what if Rails but in Crystal Lang? And it was sort of one of a few projects trying to do the same thing. Kemal, K-E-M-A-L, being like the Sinatra clone in...
I forgot all about Kemal. Yeah. That was...
Yeah. And now we've got Kemal with two A's instead of an E and an A.
Yeah.
So it's even more confusing.
I think it's pronounced Kemal, or at least that's how I've been pronouncing it. I don't actually know, but
that'll make it easier to distinguish.
For this conversation, it'll make it easier to distinguish. But yeah, that's the Sinatra of the Crystal world. So Amber's great. I love Amber. I'm going to talk about just like some differences, though, to set people's frames. So Amber is inspired by Rails and has a similar folder structure and pattern, has same idea of controllers. However, it's not exactly Rails, and that's because Crystal's typed. And it being compiled, it introduces some variations that you can't do in Crystal in the same way that's done in Rails, because Rails relies on a lot of metaprogramming. That's just not a thing in Crystal. It kind of is a thing. I say that. They have macros, which are compile time metaprogramming. So you can like give an array list to a name and it will multiply that out and write all the code. It's kind of like a tribute accessor. So you just do that in the symbol. That will be your method for you. Shorthand stuff like that. You can do some pretty impressive stuff with macros. So we also have active record patterned ORMs. There's at least a couple of them. There's one that comes out of the box with Amber called Granite, which covers all your bases. It's actually pretty much on par with where active record was going into Rails 6. The only thing it doesn't have is automatic connection switching in the same breadth of the way that sharding works. But otherwise, they're basically one-to-one feature parity, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
The other one is Jennifer. And I actually personally kind of prefer Jennifer. It's a little bit more robust and it has a little bit more of a forgiving syntax. And just there's some other niceties about it that I like. Also is that the guy who wrote Jennifer, if I remember correctly, I think he was actually writing it as part of his PhD thesis. The difference in how the code is structured and organized and the approaches to things when you have somebody who's going for their doctorate versus the people who just wrote from experience, it is night and day difference. And that makes the maintainability of it and the ease of understanding the code a much higher level. It also built in migrations, which Granite doesn't have. It relies on another one from the outside, which adds its own complications. This is like a thing in the Crystal ecosystem where a lot of people try to make things very modular. And so you have lots of little libraries that then stack up and make and solve a final solution, which is very Ruby-like. That has not worked out well. There's a lot of libraries that get created and then the language grows and things change and people realize that things don't work and it changes really quickly. And then you have dependencies scattered out about and somebody wrote it and now they're not around. How do you maintain it? And that's a typical dependency nightmare. It just happens a lot faster. Sounds like Jennifer JavaScript. Being all in one is really nice. Yeah, it has similar challenges as JavaScript. The biggest ones actually come though from the language itself, getting improvements and having changes over time. A lot of the original languages were written pre-1.0, which is like 5+ years ago. So it's quite a long time ago. It's 1.13 right now. And I think you're going to be 1.14 in the next like week or two, something similar to that. So a lot has changed, especially around concurrency. Classes that are available, there's some things that have gotten removed from the standard library and moved to their own shards. And that's the version of a gem in Crystal is a shard. And there's just a lot of changes that have happened. So now we've got bit rot, which happens. Part of how I got into working with Amber, it had gone through some bit rot. The maintainers weren't around anymore. And I was like, I'll do it. Sign me up. And let me tell you, anybody who volunteers to take over an open source project comes with a lot of headaches. There's just so many things that you don't know.
Until now, observability was metrics, logs, and traces. It was reliability budgets, error rates, and latencies. It was big acronyms on a central dashboard. In short, it was what the ops team cared about, not the developers. But Honeybadger is changing that. Of course, you need the big picture, the single pane of glass that lets you know what your system is doing and that it's operating normally. But individual users matter too. User experience is more than just a line on a dashboard. Honeybadger's observability platform lets you drill down into the details, into the individual user experiences that drive product development and your business forward. It helps you understand your product and your users as much as it does your systems and performance. Honeybadger's free developer plan includes error tracking, uptime monitoring, custom charts and dashboards, and 50 megabytes per day of structured event logging. To get started, visit honeybadger.io. That's www.honeybadger.io.
When you're doing the work that the Rails core team of what, 10 plus people, I don't even know how many people are on the Rails core team. Like, that's you now. And you need to be an expert in HTTP and databases and browsers and literally everything, background jobs, concurrency, everything. Yep. There's so much to know. But it's also probably one of the ways for you to accelerate your learning and knowledge, just taking on a massive project like that. Like, now I have to find the answer to this random question as fast as possible because I have 150 other questions to answer and whatnot, or bugs to fix and whatever else.
So Amber had aged for a while and it was using Webpack and an old version of Webpack, like required node 14. And I was like going through, trying to update it, use an old version of Bootstrap. And I was thinking through, like, do I really want to make the asset pipeline like this? Is that even where the world is going right now? And I was like, I don't know. And I don't think I actually want to spend my time building a solution for a standard that we're at large moving away from. I want to, you know, skate where the puck is going and not skate where the puck is coming from.
Yep.
So I built an import map shard and I'm actually just going to make it a whole front end solution for fingerprinting because we don't have much for front end assets. It's actually probably the biggest hole in the Crystal ecosystem is around view rendering and asset management. So I was like, okay, well, I want to do this. I like stimulus. There's a lot of things that I like from Ruby and Rails. It's my first love. It's my full-time job. Basically, America runs on Ruby and Rails and Apple. And there's a lot of things from that that I want to bring over to work under the Crystal ecosystem because they work great. And import maps is one of those. Stimulus is the other one. I want to use Stimulus in my projects. I love Stimulus. I love what it stands for. It just makes sense the way you can organize things. Every project that I've used Stimulus on, I can very easily jump back in and understand the complex reactive features and how they're organized much more easily than I can for like a React app. React apps, when they're small, are easy, and they get very big and they get very complicated very quickly, and they can become extremely difficult to manage. And that's why I've never found a React app that doesn't have bugs. We've all had it. They have view problems in some way. Things interact funny. They get into weird states. You come up with bugs that you can't even reproduce consistently. Like, it just happens.
Have you ever looked into inertia at all?
I have, yeah. I had very little use with them because I just looked at them and was like, this is kind of like a modern jQuery, like a nicer version of what jQuery was trying to do back in the day. And so I was like, I don't know that that's what I want to adopt into a framework that I'm trying to maintain, because I don't know that that's actually the way the world is going. I'd like to think that WASM is going to be a much bigger part of the everyday web developer. My gut instinct is that's going to be a thing. The other thing is CSS3. I think there's a lot of stuff that what DHH is doing and advocating for with like a no-build pipeline, to me, is really resonating. Like, actually, a lot of this is making sense, which is what I'm trying to gear this front end around. Skating where the puck is going is also what I've been doing with the AI research stuff. So here I have a chance with this framework to build in a language that AI doesn't know about, or it knows very little about, which actually gives me the chance to create something and then create documents that are AI first. Because what's interesting about AI, you've probably seen this, AI reflects what's popular, not what's correct. So The example that I have is that if you ask AI, you ask GPT-4, most of these other models to do something and write code, especially if it's related to styling, it's going to use some type of popular framework most of the time to default to it. Or if you say use Bootstrap or use Tailwind or something like that, it's going to reflect what's mostly written about in blog posts. If you ask it to use CSS3 only, it'll make tons of mistakes, like horribly obvious mistakes. And it's like, well, why? I'm asking you to use a 4-year-old feature. Why can't it do it? Well, it's not what was popular. So what's popular is what AI reflects. So this gives you a chance of like, well, if I start something from scratch, can I write something in a way that AI understands it? And then a person with little or no knowledge can then use how I've structured this information to be productive. I pulled that off with a really cool experiment. I wrote a shard that lets you write apps that natively interact with AI models on your laptop. One of the bets that I'm making long-term is that I want a personal AI. I do not want my data sitting in a warehouse with OpenAI or Google. I don't trust big corporations, and I think everybody has a reason not to. And I think that's just the general belief is like, no, I don't trust you, but I have to just live with the fact that a big company has the cloud and all of the compute resources, because I'll never run a computer that's fast enough. And that's not true. And that's a misconception that I hope that everybody here listens and goes, wow, okay, great. DHH moving out of the cloud was one of the big things where I was like, huh, that's interesting. A bare bones hardware is a multiple better performance with the same code base compared to similar, air quotes there, similar hardware that you get in the cloud, right? So if you provision something in the cloud with the same amount of CPU or RAM, and then you run the same thing on your hardware or equivalent, whatever you can get for closest matching, you're going to get a much better performance on the bare metal. Well, then my thought was like, well, is that the same with AI? Are we misunderstanding what our home computers can do? Or do we still treat them like toys when they're actually workhorses? And that's proven to be true. It's proven to be really true.
Yeah, like the little transcription thing I did on the Raspberry Pi, like that's not even using one of the TPU hats where we could actually take advantage of some better hardware to do that. That's a Raspberry Pi that costs $50 or less. And your Apple Silicon laptop is going to be a heck of a lot faster. And like use Amazon's assistant for like turning lights off and stuff in the house. But I don't need it to go to the cloud to do that work, to then go trigger a local thing that should be 100% local to turn a light off or on. You know, that makes no sense. And I think it was the Home Assistant team is working pretty hard on trying to make that built in. So they'll have their own built in voice assistant that you will run 100% local, which would be sweet. And also all the CPUs are starting to build in hardware specifically for this. Clearly, the direction going forward is you don't need the supercomputer at Amazon to go do that work for you. You can just do it at home on your regular old device, your phone. That's
crazy.
Which
I think what we're finding out anyway is that the computers in the cloud aren't as supercomputer as we thought they were.
No.
We've been a little oversold on what that... I think it was 100% true 15 years ago. I think it became less true over the last decade. And then in the last 4 years, especially, it became like completely untrue. That the hardware that you can buy is incredibly more powerful and that managing it is nowhere near as difficult as it was 15 years ago. That's how I got started in technology. I was an IT guy, wasn't a programmer, which everybody thought that you can do both. It was very frustrating. But it was true. All of the problems that cloud solved was very accurate. You had 15 years ago, Git was not normal. You'd have a room full of programmers all working on a single or maybe two computers. Virtualization wasn't a thing. I remember VMware was still very popular when it was just exploding in 2009, but it was not the everyday thing. It was still very bare bones. It was kind of like small businesses were built on top of inventions from some garage inventor. And internet was still also not really that great. You're still talking about people that getting the 100 megabyte connection was a luxury, even for business.
Yeah. And it costs a ridiculous amount.
No, it's nothing.
Like everything's pushing lower and lower, like $50 a month for a gig symmetric, which is insane. And now you've got so much better software too. And we don't have hard drives like we used to. We have SSDs, which is like crazy power, which is all what the latest Rails improvements are all on too, which are like, why do we need to run Redis and put stuff in RAM when like your SSD is almost as fast as RAM these days? Then like we could just put it there permanently and it's almost as fast. And we don't need that like half millisecond performance improvement of having it in RAM or whatever instead of storage is like not a big deal for 99% of applications. So it's interesting how much has seemingly not changed. And then all of a sudden we're realizing like, actually, this isn't the 2000s anymore. Like this is crazy what we have like in your phone. And then that partly might be because like your phone, you got to put stuff through the Apple store to get it to your phone. And we can't just like take full advantage of our phone's power and write apps for it without like getting Apple's approval and stuff. And so it's also got a limited interface. You just have the screen to type on and stuff. So it's not seen as being as powerful as it actually is, but it's insane how good your phone is. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Like the LiDAR that's in it. Incredible. It's so
underutilized. And that stuff you just take for granted because the only time you use it is for like Face ID or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not used that much.
I built an AI shard that lets you run these AI models locally. But the thing that makes it unique isn't just that you can run local models because you have OLAMA for that. And it's still basically like an HTTP request and it wraps Llama CPP. The thing that I ran into through a lot of experiments is that I wanted to be able to talk to the models and get a machine understandable format response, JSON or YAML, but I prefer JSON.
I thought you were going to say tabular CSVs.
No, I learned my lesson. I've been kicked too many times. When I was diving through the docs of Llama CPP, I saw that they had these things called grammars, and I had never heard of an official grammar. Turns out it's a whole thing. If anybody's curious, you can look up what the BNF grammar is. The Llama CPP one is a little different. They build on top of it, and it has very little documentation. So I was just like, all right, well, I guess it's time to just mess around and find out. And through a bunch of experimentation, I figured out that I can change how the model works. I can prompt the model in natural language, give it the data that I want, but using the grammar, I can structure its response and force it to respond in perfect JSON every single time, which meant that you're saving. Right now, if anybody's built anything that wraps with ChatGPT, you know, you can get it to respond in JSON, right? That's a solved problem, but you have to give it a prompt. You have to then say, here's your response template. Always respond in perfect JSON. It doesn't. It makes mistakes. Even GPT-4 makes mistakes. So you've got to retry. It can add in some funny things and misunderstand what you're trying to do. It's a common problem with LLMs that the longer your prompt is with multiple instructions, it's going to forget the stuff in the middle. It's going to remember the beginning and the end the most, and then that's what's going to be most accurate. So if you have a long, complex process or a lot of data that you want extracted or anything, it's a total fail. The grammars let me completely circumvent that because I'm not giving it its response template. It's controlling it at the time the tokens are being generated, which changed everything, which is funny because nobody also cares. I've been telling people for over a year and I'm like, this is incredible. They're like, I couldn't care less. And oh man, it's killing me. And so I was like, somebody's going to get it someday. And then OpenAI finally came out with structured responses. And I was like, ah, they're onto me. Somebody's going to figure this out.
Chat interface was the perfect thing to launch for the beginning, where it's like anybody can sit down and play with it. But to actually make it practical and usable, it has to be able to talk like computers talk, which is these days JSON responses. Like that's the main thing and the most widely parsable. Any language, any system will be able to parse that and understand it and work with it. So that's really nice to have that like reliable, because otherwise you're just kind of gambling and then you're like, oh, it didn't know what we wanted, so maybe we'll try it again and maybe it'll give us the correct response the second time. Like you can't build products and stuff on top of that if it's that unreliable.
Right.
You really need the true like understanding of JSON coming out of that and having structured responses. That makes it widely more accessible to developers to use.
Yep. The interesting thing about it being JSON is that I can have it respond in JSON so that a regular DOM application can then utilize the response, right? So the idea is that we operate software now. When you make a web app, who's clicking the button? You or me, the user, we operate the software. But by making it so that the AI can ingest information and then respond with JSON, it can operate the software. So it's not a layer where I'm just chatting with the AI. Now using JSON, that's completely missing the point, right? That's skating where the puck is coming from, not skating where the puck is going. I want the AI to operate the software for me, which means that now I have this AI that I can use and say, hey, run commands like creating databases, create migrations, write software for me, write my controllers, write my tests. And it's not like I use Cursor all the time, right? It's not like the Cursor experience where you're looking at one file. I can say, here's a feature. I actually came up with a whole language while I was sitting at the pool in Vegas. My wife's sister had cancer last year. So there's like 7 months where her life was just on hold. So then the timing of the treatment ended perfectly where it was with my wife's birthday. So I planned a trip to Vegas. And while we were there, it was like my brain just kind of unfolded from the knot that it had been in. And I was like, yeah, I need to get this out. And I came up with this whole structure for how to write feature stories in a way that then translates into a pattern and convention that AI can reproduce. AI is really good at following conventions. I was like, wow, DHH is onto something. He doesn't even know it. If you have conventions, the AI model actually gets incredibly more powerful because it has less things that it has to guess about. AI doesn't have a mental model. So if you structure things correctly and you phrase things correctly and you write things correctly in a way that your class names, method names, and variable names clearly explain what they're doing to something that has no context and no mental model, that it can still follow along with what it's doing, it becomes exponentially more effective. So I actually do have this really nice app. We'll eventually make a UI for it, which is what I've been experimenting with recently. But I can give it a description of an app, tell it things like I came up with a funny example of the helpful husband. I just need something to help me manage life. Like there isn't a product out here that lets you manage life. Life is too dynamic for most software, but I want a Jira that's actually good for like my house projects and helping me track my budget. And like my vacation plans and family members. Jira is not great for that, but it is a good example. And I was like, all right, here, come up with a helpful husband app. Come up with something that lets me track my home projects and lets me have a budget that's assigned to it and keep track of the phases of the budget and like scheduling it and other things that are just not necessarily a project, but like birthdays and travel plans and have I booked my flights. I can dictate features to the AI with things like, I need to schedule a vacation, come up with a feature that helps outline this and then operate on it, actually perform these functions and use that software. And it's able to do it consistently. Consistently is the key, because anything with the AI, you can get it to work once, try to get it to work 10 times in a row. Good luck.
I mean, that makes sense. You're going to get the 10 different outputs most of the time. So is that something you have that people can check out?
Yeah, it's called Lamero. It's published and you can write apps with it now. So there's also docs in there that you can give to Cursor. I have an example that I published in there so that if you're using Cursor, which I'm a huge fan of, and if anybody's ever curious about questions, I have tons of workflows that make it super effective. I've been using it for over a year. It's got stuff on there so you can get started writing an app. The only caveat is I only have Mac hardware and it is geared towards people with Macs. So if you don't have a Mac, I know it will work because it wraps Llama CPP. I just don't have the ins and outs to make sure that you're getting the maximum GPU usage. So your token generation might be a little slow, but it will still work.
That's cool. I want to play with that for sure. Recently, working on projects, like, it's frustrating with how I can get some things done so quickly, but then like I get in the weeds on so many things. It still feels a little bit like, why are there so many decisions to make along the way? And if that can get you over the hump of like, here's version one, and you use it and you're like, eh, it's kind of frustrating. You can either fix it yourself or tell it like, actually, I need to be a little bit more specific about how I want this to work. And then you can go update that. And that seems to be like the biggest reason why so many things are so slow to be developed. It's still humans. We're the worst part about computers. Like computers are really fast, but I feel like humans are what make it so tricky all the time.
Oh, yeah. So one thing that comes out trying to explain AI to other people is that you come to find out that a lot of people don't know how to explain what it is that they know how to do. They just know that it works, which means that when they start prompting AI, that type of intuitive expertise comes out where they just say phrases and they know intuitively what that means as a process, but the AI doesn't understand the larger context. So I'm hoping that what this does is it improves the ability for others to communicate their ideas more clearly and effectively. Because if you could teach an AI to reflect what it is that you're trying to do and create, you can then transfer that knowledge to other people more effectively. And I've found that to be very consistently true.
The funny thing my wife and I will often argue about, and she's like not a project manager, but like a very high level person at the company she works at that's like a Fortune 20 company. And I'm a three person company. And it's funny because she works with all these technical people and manages software projects and all that. And she'll say something and it'll be like vague enough where I'm like, what are you actually talking about? Like, what specifics are you wanting here? Because that was the biggest thing, I think, when I started to get into programming, which was all of the details are the most important thing. Like, this is the difference between good software and bad software, something that works the way you want it to, something that guides you in the right direction on how it should be used and all of that stuff. Which is something before then I just like never thought about and literally remember looking at like a desk or a spoon or anything and being like, someone decided the shape of the spoon. They decided to keep sharp edges instead of rounding over the edges on the metal. They decided to put a texture on here so it won't slip in your fingers as much, whatever, like every little piece of this thing. And I used to just pick up a spoon and be like, I don't like this spoon, but I like that spoon. And I could never tell you why. And it came down to all those little details. And that's like the other thing here of when you get into being able to train it on those little details, it's going to decide, we'll do it this way because maybe that's what it sees as the most popular option. It'll do that. But then you might be like, whoa, whoa, hold on. I don't want that. I want this. Right. But I think it'll help train a lot of people to be better at paying attention to the details, I'm hoping.
Yeah, being able to articulate their idea a little bit better. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping too, especially for developers. The more and more I talk to people out in the wild, so to speak, because I, you know, I work from home, so I don't leave my house that much. But the more and more I talk to people out there and what they're doing, developers tend to get stuck on the technology side of things and they forget that people use it. And then they end up missing how it is that people describe what it is that they want. People describe experiences and outcomes most of the time. Developers describe the technical side of things. And if you can speak in terms of outcomes and experience, but understand how to implement in the technical, you're in a much better path.
Yeah, like Matt Swanson was the first person I heard say like product engineers, which is people that understand the customers, the users, what are they using it for? Why are they using it? What are they trying to solve? And then your job is like, make that work, not just like the technical side of things for the fun and the challenge of how many requests per second can we get out of this?
Right.
Like, it doesn't matter half the time. And David's a great proponent of that too, of just like, Rails may not be the fastest thing, but look at all the money we can make from our business building it in Rails, because we care about building the product first. Rails happens to be the tool that we use for that, which is similar to you talking about tools earlier of like, your favorite tools are the hand tools, you know, because they allow you to craft a lot better. You know, a chainsaw can get the job done faster, but it's not going to be near as precise in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, there's something to be said too about just rapidly being able to develop an app that solves a problem. Because if you get to the point where performance is like, oh no, we have to optimize performance. Oh no, we have a growth problem. How terrible. We're successful. Oh, what are we going to do? Oh no.
Yeah, it's the
it's great.
Wiping your tears away with $20 bills.
Only 20s? Pocket change. Yeah. With me having Amber, I get a lot of people that will, it's usually people on Discord that will send me messages like, oh, do you rewrite all the Rails apps? And it's like, no, it's not worth it. Like the whole rewrite versus refactor, especially into a new language, you've got to have something that's like super legacy and painful to maintain to make it worth it. Because the hyper optimization of the amount of requests per second can typically be solved very inexpensively, even still in the cloud. Even the cloud is still pretty cheap, relatively speaking. Like the amount of money that you're going to save in EC2 instances by like rewriting your whole app from Ruby into Crystal, you'll never make your money back compared to the amount of engineering time that goes into it. Maybe if you're a Shopify, like maybe they're, you know, gargantuan. But even then, I don't know. Your apps get so complicated. The amount of time and energy and expertise and the knowledge and intricacies of everything, like you probably will just foot gun yourself.
Yeah. And it's like Shopify is doing 20% or whatever it is of e-commerce online. So it's like, yeah, at their scale, but that's like, ridiculous scale in comparison.
That's unicorn status.
They have more money than time. They can invest on those things that are like micro optimizations because that'll make them a heck of a lot of money,
right?
In savings or whatever. But for you, it's the whole I could build this in a weekend thing. Not worth it for sure.
I mean, I'm almost there with my own AI model, which is pretty cool. It won't rewrite stuff. I actually don't know that it ever will. What I originally got into that task for was actually for legacy application management, because when you go in and you take over a code base, you inherit a lot of past decisions that you have no context over. One of my favorite tools is API Doc. It totally looks like it was built in 2008 because, you know, it was, but it's a cool tool if you know how to use it. And it, especially where we've got this Rails app that we've been maintaining since I think it started in Rails 4, and we're not quite onto the latest one yet, but we're still maintaining this and upgrading it as we go. So we stay like slightly behind the latest release. So knowing that is that when you have this app, we have hundreds of controllers. I mean, it's a huge monolith. And you've got an app this size and you've gotten through major releases of things, you're going to have methods that change. Things get deprecated, things get moved. I need something to reference a point in time version and compare what that point in time is, what the next point in time is going to be. And API Doc is so far the best one I can get that does that in a nice side-by-side way to be able to see. I love that little version bar that they have that shows you like it changes and then when it ends. That's the best feature. Nothing else really exists like that. I wanted to make something like that for my own code base, because AI can
be
read
awesome.
Your Git commits. So you can have it start at the beginning of your Git history and have it build through your versions by reading your commits and the files that are in it, and then the methods. It can parse all of that. And then it can add additional context from, because it can interpret things as it's going. So if you've written good code, it's a very good litmus test.
Ooh, that's interesting. There are many, many times where, you know, I'll be upgrading. Actually, I just did this. I was upgrading from Rails 7.2 to 8, and the API controllers just started breaking for me. And it happened to be that rate limiting was added to the main controllers. It got added to the API controllers. The caching feature is required for rate limiting. So then caching was added to the API controllers, but helper methods were never in there, but they're now required for caching. So it had to be that helper methods are included first, then caching. And that was done in like the JBuilder gem for you. But now caching is already done inside of Rails. JBuilder tries to add helper methods, then caching a second time, but it can't include the same module twice. There's no point in doing that. But because now they're out of order, it doesn't work and you have to like patch this thing. And it took me like an hour to trace through like, okay, why was this added? Because it like blows up internally in Rails and I have to go between these two gems and my application. And then I'm in GitHub looking at the history of the caching file, reading the previous commits and the lines that had changed that were relevant to what I'm looking at, and then the git blames and whatever, and piecing together, like, what is the story here? Like, how did we end up here and what broke?
I'm thoroughly impressed you did that in only an hour.
It just happened to be like, I got lost in like 20 minutes, then had lunch and then came back and it was like, you know, one of those times where you take a break and you come back and everything's very clear. That's what happened pretty much. And I was like, oh, I think I found it now.
I could have killed a half a day doing that kind of problem because like include orders is the kind of thing you don't really get an error that's meaningful. It's just pure experimentation at that point.
Yeah. Like it literally was method missing, whatever. And I was like, how is that possible? It was fine previously. And then if you search for the method, it's like not referenced anywhere hardly. And you're like, how did this even break? That's the stuff that I love API doc for, because it's like this method is now in three different locations and it was only defined at one place before. And now like it's been extracted to several modules that one might override the other one and add stuff with like it calls the original method, then add some extra steps or something. And it's like that's hard to track down in code, but that's also hard, stuff that the AI could analyze for you and probably could have given you the summary of what happened, why did this change, whatever, and give you a much faster hint at like, here's where you should look. It may not be able to understand exactly what the issue was or how to fix it or something, but at least it could for sure analyze the commit history and changes and all that and give you the context that you had to like manually build up yourself over a day or an hour or whatever it might be. It's definitely going to be longer than what AI would be able to go and do for you.
Oh yeah. AI is the ultimate bureaucrat. So if there's solutions that could be solved through someone who like is the ultimate type A personality in terms of organization and documentation, that AI now fills that role, which means we now all have a perfect type A personality assistant. It's just getting it to a point where it's in everybody's hands. But I mean, I want that. I'm surprised nobody's built it since then. Because truthfully, outside of like analyzing commit messages or like doing comparison and some logic and reasoning, a lot of this stuff was already possible and just nobody did it. And I just couldn't understand why it was only one site really has it.
Yeah, it might have been just like just hard enough that people didn't bother building those things in the past. And now it's obviously kind of easy to do that now. And it's like now a bunch of people jump on it. But
that's fair.
It's probably back to that, like, it appeared to be hard, so nobody even bothered trying in the past. And now it's like, well, I could just ask it to do anything for me. And
it reminds me of, like, you ever gone to a place where people are lined up and there's, like, two doors and everybody's in line at one door and the other door is open. You're like, well, why isn't anybody walking through? Everybody just got in line because they just assumed that you couldn't go through the other door.
It happens all the time. Every all day I'm at Costco checking out.
You go to Costco every day?
Every day.
Got to get every the hot time. Dog, man.
The hot dog at the Canadian Costco is $1.50 CAD, which means it's even cheaper.
Oh, 30% cheaper. We should import those.
If I lived in New York, I'd just cross the border every day.
You spend extra 30% traveling to Canada every day.
Don't get gas in Canada. You will not save money.
And it's all in liters. Still, I have to detox from around the world.
Well, gentlemen, I guess we're about at time. Any other things you want to chat about?
Oh, I will not stop talking if you leave an open invitation. So how about we plan a repeat someday in the future?
Yeah, it was good having you on. I'm excited to check out this stuff. We'll have to get links from you and put them in the show notes so other people can check it out too and whatnot. But yeah, this was fun. Miss hanging out in St. Louis this year, but we'll make it happen one of these days.
Yeah, I'll definitely be back. Don't worry. The home office is still in St. Louis. So
well, good.
Guaranteed to come and visit at some point.
It's always one of the highlights, hanging out with you and the team. It's always fun. I can't believe it's Thursday already. Jeez. Jason, is your sabbatical start Monday or is it?
It technically starts Monday. I've been telling everybody I started it mentally like 2 weeks ago.
So. Yeah, smart. I'm jealous. The sabbatical thing. My boss hasn't given me a sabbatical yet. So need to convince my boss for that. But I think that would be awesome. Although I have a feeling that the sabbatical will be ending just when I'm like ready for the real sabbatical to start, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's how every vacation works too.
I'll spend a week in Vegas and that statement will not be true.
Oh man. All right. Good chatting with you guys and catch you soon.
See ya.